I really feel not loved this Christmas. For many years now, an institution that was in this church when I came here to pastor, I have kept alive because of my belief that the day might come, should Jesus tarry, when this church has a pastor who needs the institution more than I do. But more importantly, there are certain annual testimonials, like a vote of confidence from the congregation, where you testify to your attitude about the position of the pastor. One of those institutions was an annual Christmas offering for the pastor in the 46 years of this church's existence. To my knowledge, they've never missed a Christmas until today, when not one soul on my staff, and that's the way it's always been done, I don't remember it, someone on my staff reminds me that the pastor's Christmas offering has to be taken. Sometimes over the years I've designated it for something and said so publicly. At other times, I think one of the annual offerings, when we started Secret Six, well, one of the secrets was my participation in that. And sometimes I've said I'm going to spend it. It's pretty apparent that I don't live from annual pastor's offering to annual pastor's offering, because the desperate need that I have is reflected by the fact that I didn't think of it. It is an institution I want to stay with this church. It doesn't have a thing to do with whether I need it or the next pastor needs it. It has to do with retaining in this church something that is eroding quickly across the church world. One of the two purposes that I came to attack and establish: a return to faith and respect for God-ordained leadership. It has to do with your respect as testified to God for the office that He ordained, namely that of the pastor. Now, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take one up every night this week. I mean, it's pretty ludicrous to make it an issue of need. But to my knowledge, about 99.5% of all the offerings that come to the church are in response to my teaching and designated to me. I established that a long time ago. If you want to give to the church, you make checks out to the church. If we're in a cranky mood, we'll send them back to you. I came to this church to teach respect for God-ordained leadership. I came to town already too rich to satisfy most Christians' tastes. I came to town in a limousine, provided me as one of the perks by Sunset Mausoleum, which I saved from bankruptcy. And it was that work with that nonprofit corporation that made the church invite me down as a financial consultant. The people worrying about making me rich are too late. I came to town in a limousine. I don't know how many we've got. Gotta stop and count. We collect old classic cars. They're like Persian rugs. They get worth more as you use them. I personally haven't bought a new car in 20 years. I think it's idiotic. You do what you want. Ain't no way this Scotchman will let the dealers and the car companies force me into a 50% drop as I drive it out the door. I don't want. Cheap carpet laid and tract homes. I want old classic houses that we can refurbish and they're worth more than. You gave over $18 million for me to buy a home. I bought it in the name of the church, but I didn't go out and buy some tract home. I bought a Pasadena mansion out of a probate court that I don't even like to tell what I bought it for, because it would suggest that we own the bank or something and got special favors. Got all the contents, of which one of half dozen rugs was worth more than the whole house. Got it all for $42,000. I could have done what I wanted, but I bought the house in the church's name. These are my personal matters. So this isn't an issue of riches. I haven't come in here and sold any prints lately. I haven't stopped printing. I haven't stopped paying. God has gifted me, and I'm a living testimony to God's Word. That's all irrelevant. I came to teach a church to respect the office of the pastor. If a mechanical jackrabbit occupies the post, and you play records of my teaching out of his mouth for 20 years after I'm dead, you have these offerings for the pastor. Clear?
Yes, sir.
I fault this church on one ground. I remember in King's House 1, when I missed an important offering, the congregation waving their envelopes and shouting, and not letting me leave till I took that offering. Now I'm about half ticked off that I'm being taken for granted. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep the first offering this morning. Go make the first offering this morning, the pastor's offering. I don't care what you decided you wanted it for. The first offering today is the pastor's offering. Doesn't matter what you want. I know what the pledge slips say. I can designate as I choose. But I'm going to take another one next Sunday and one every day that I'm here this week. Because I sense something on the horizon. I say I'm half ticked off because there's a twinkle in my eye if you were watching on radio. because you all give, not caring if I put it in a trunk and fly out in the Pacific Ocean and drop it in it, with no strings attached as a response to my teaching, after you already got it, and with the full knowledge that the Lord's already given me the tithe, as the person standing in the place of the Levites of the Old Testament for this church, it's easy for you to think, well, why have a Christmas offering? Because we write all our checks same way anyway. Because I want you to suck in your breath and pause, and that's what we do on these periodic days, anniversary and Christmas and birthday. I mean, I frankly think New Year's Day is a better day than Christmas anyway. You've had a chance to get a little more money back. The point is, I will not fail in my objective. And in the respect that you give, which I appreciate, and the relationship that only 18 years of standing together and fighting the forces of evil and moving in faith on God's plan can bring to a congregation, I still don't want you to lose the abstract distinction between the office of the pastor, regardless of the person that God puts in that place, and the present pastor that you now have. The pastor who occupies the chair might determine how much you give, depending upon the juvenility of your spiritual perspective. But this event cannot be removed from the religious culture of this church. That's the point I'm making. I don't care if you so love this pastor, should that be the case, that you give the same amount year in, year out. I want this event. As we tell the whole world, this is a church still biblically old-fashioned enough to recognize that the pastor is a domata, God's gift to the church. And you show appreciation by these annual love offerings as a testimony to what that office is worth to you. Clear?
Yes, sir.
The pastor's offering starts right now. I'm 65. Do you have any trouble figuring out what the check should be for? This is beginning my 19th year. I expect to live and preach and pastor till I'm 120. I weigh 230. I realized that I had forgotten the pastor's offering and nobody reminded me. My temperature soared to 1,000 degrees centigrade. This is 1994. And the 25th day of the month. And the 12th month of the year. Now, somewhere in all of that symbolism, you can figure out a Christmas offering for the pastor. Oh, I'll be here next Sunday. still be so blessed of God that all my enemies will still hate me. This will make them hate me a little more. I promise to spend some of it on cigars. Do you understand what I'm saying in the midst of all the humor?
Yes, sir.
This was a gross mistake today because I spent 18 years reiterating that this is one of the good things that was a habit pattern of the church before I came here. And I intend that we continue it as long as I'm living and breathing and pastor of this church. I'm sure my staff is severely chastised. They're all going to give a week's pay as a pastor's Christmas offering, so it'll help them remember next year. Or, since it's a free country, I'll reduce their weekly pay for the rest of the year to whatever their Christmas offering amount is. The word to the wise is it better be remembered for the sake of this church and its future. And the objective we have of understanding God's domata is God's gift to the church, not something you create, hire, and own. So the Christmas offering starts now, whatever it is. You know that. It's a testimony to the value of God's gift. Plus, we start another week, the last week of the year. Let's make December victorious without a marathon. Come on, get on the telephone. To this date, I have not drawn down the anniversary offering that you gave on Anniversary Sunday, which was an encouraging testimony that the congregation still believes in its pastor. But I haven't drawn it down. I left it in the general church budget. In that case, the point had been made. In this case, and I have to guard against these things, and I'm sure you understand it, I have to guard against staff people who so take for granted that that's what I'm going to do, that they don't even distinguish between the normal application of the funds, which the testimony of the ever-expanding ministry is very clear about. And they have to learn. Even if I make the decision to put it all in the same place, a new transmitter or a new contract or the general expenses of the church, which get pretty tight toward the end of the year, it isn't their choice to make. You understand me?
Yes, sir.
They don't have the right to treat them all alike. You don't delegate to them the right to apply the funds. There are lots of things I have to teach. I have to teach against an attitude on the part of those on my staff that say, well, you know, ends up all the same. Somebody takes the same money and just puts it in the birthday offering. It's my job to make sure that that attitude's not allowed to prevail. Even though I may decide just leave it there. I don't need it, don't want it. My life's the Lord's. I've learned what I try to teach you, you cannot give Him. He really does want to bless you, but only after you totally give up to Him. So this pastor's offering is important, and I'm glad to see you're responding. There'll be another one next Sunday, too. You ain't ever going to forget it again. The rule is, you forget it next year, any one of these special offerings, as I did once before, the whole month will be a special offering for that purpose. I'm tenacious about the things I teach. I din things into people, as Galatians 6 says, and I get on the telephone. I'm going to use a little map that is like all the maps on this subject. This one happens to be out of Peter Lemassurier's book. A quick look at the passages of the pyramid. I don't think I have to waste any time on its marvelous structural quality, the magnificent replica of the northern half of the earth, the squaring of a circle, the mathematical encasement of astronomical movements, the massive construction, the alignment to true north, the massive blocks cut to 1/50th of an inch, variation glued together, impossible to duplicate with the primitive methods that science attributes to that age. The most important are the inner passages. Take a look now. As you go down this passage, it was when the dragon constellation provided the North Star, Thuban, this descending passage was perfectly aligned with Thuban at 2141 B.C. Correct? At the same time, unlike the lines of the blocks which were vertical, there are markers, scored lines, that if extended out into space to the vault of the heavens, hits Alcyon and the Pleiades like a crosshair at a specific time, 2141 B.C. Correct? We've taught you that. This becomes a benchmark marker that in the precession of the equinoxes that affects the alignment of the earth in relation to the North Star, one time in almost 26,000 years, this descending passage is lined up with Thuban, the dragon star, typifying or symbolizing man's activity under the control of Satan, ever downward to the end. If you take 1 inch to a year, the 1 inch being the sacred inch from which is comprised the sacred cubit, of which the Ark of the Covenant, the Temple of Solomon, and the Great Temple prophesied to be built in the millennium by Ezekiel, 1/500,000,000th of the axes of the earth, North Pole to South Pole, and take those inches, which, as I've said, only vary from the British and English inch by a half, a hair's breadth, 1/11,000, and count it 1 year to an inch, you will come to the point where the miraculous exodus of God's people takes off and reverses this downward pull in 1453 B.C. You then count in this low passage typifying deliverance under the law, stooped under the weight of it, this special people, not the rest of the world. Count 1 inch to a year, you will come to the birth of Christ in 2 B.C., and it opens into a great gallery, the truth and light, which opens up 286.1 inches at exactly 33 A.D. The rest of the world, traveling down, will bring us to the point of the Protestant Reformation, 286.1 inches back, there is a blasting open where the life of faith was opened up again to the history of man, and the revelation of deliverance through Christ as a miraculous work of the Spirit up through this well shaft blasts out to the right at the same point where this grand gallery opens up, and you continue on toward the King's Chamber. Now, traditional pyramid Egyptology theories have said this was a funeral pyre, or a funeral burial place, and that they started to bury down here, and before they finished this room, the king came down, said, "I don't like it, I want to be higher." So they went back somehow, went up here, for some reason dropping the plug when they were done, and went over to the queen's chamber, and the king came. Apparently the plug wasn't there yet, or he had a long climb up this hole, and said, "I don't like it, I want to be higher." So they said, "Okay," abandoned the queen's chamber and went on up to the king's chamber. And he apparently was satisfied, but he was never buried in that open coffer. And maybe the builders decided, since he changes his mind so often, we ought to not tell him and build these other cavities up here in case he wants to go higher. What I'd have done if I was a construction crew and that was the way it was coming down. Bull's Kabbalah. This is a time capsule of prophecy. This is the monument and the altar of witness at the border and the center of Egypt, prophesied in Isaiah 19 to be there in the last days, where God can say, "I told you so." He wrote his message illustrating his control over history in stone. Now, the dates, beginning with Davidson and through Rutherford, have been refined through the years until these are the dates. Point down with my pencil again. 2141 B.C. 1453 is the Exodus. It took a time for science and archaeology to come. In the case of Velikovsky, within 6 to 8 years of this date for the Exodus, when previously they'd held, it occurred in the 14th century. And then, even earlier in the 13th century, about 1250 A.D., or rather B.C., now we know the pyramid was right all along. For years, they believed Christ was born in 4 B.C., based upon an erroneous interpretation of an eclipse referred to in one of the Gospels at the time of Herod. Now, further refinements and knowledge of astronomy and the events of the time have fixed the date at 2 B.C. The pyramid was right all along, and his death and resurrection in 33 A.D. where the gospel age opened up. It encases the messianic triangle of the work of Paul that saved the gospel, though many went sideways, still under law, toward the Queen's Chamber. It encases the dates of the major happenings when the age of the Gentiles and their trotting down of Jerusalem came to an end and the march toward the King's Chamber. We've not yet gotten up into those dates. Now, with all that behind us, I was reading the other night the work of Robert Bovall and Adrian Gilbert in a new book entitled The Orion Mystery. What he has done, there are problems at the outset, as with all who write on the pyramid. They'll make their contribution, but they'll encase a weakness. And you know what his weakness is when you start out, and he starts giving measurements in meters instead of the pyramid inch. He laments the fact that most Egyptologists are so fixed in their viewpoints that this is a burial monument of an egomaniac king, that if you start talking about the things we're talking about, they discount you by not calling you by the proper name pyramidologist. They call you pyramid idiots. And the weight is as strong as the weight of the medieval world that was fixed in its judgment and ego involved with its statements against Newton. Those who had the flat earth philosophy, those that felt the earth was the center of the universe, fight against change. He laments the fact that nobody wanted to listen to him in a breakthrough that he recognized that adds to pyramid measurements and knowledge, that's as much a major breakthrough as the days of Davidson and Rutherford's contributions, and post-dates as data available to the pyramidologist all the older books, of which I have them all in the library that was given to me of Adam Rutherford. But having lamented the closed mind, he never pays any attention to the work of the pyramidologists, culminating after many years in David Davidson, who went down to prove there was no divine message in the pyramid and ended up writing the most complete studies of the divine message. His book entitled The Pyramid, Its Divine Message. Ignoring the monumental work of Adam Rutherford and those between Davidson and Rutherford. So I can't recommend the book without saying it suffers those shortcomings, but I'm sure some bookstores are already bought out. What he, in essence, contributed was the fact that the three pyramids, and he goes on to say others, but the three pyramids at Giza, the large one supposedly built by Cheops, or Cheops, nobody knows really how to pronounce it, Khufu, the Greek name, that's even better, because you're more accurate on that, Cheops, during the great pyramid dynasties of the Old Kingdom, the third to the sixth dynasty, these pyramids built during that period is the Egyptologist view, all of them built during that period by these kings in succession, Cheops building the biggest one, then son and grandson getting involved, and three of them were built on that plateau of Giza. He says, here's a picture of the three, with a master design to cut through 150 pages of the book, and I think a brilliant insight as he watched the Arabian skies, having wrestled with the problem and working as an engineer out of Riyadh. He was looking up one night, and a problem that had bothered him, suddenly, in a burst of insight, was solved for him. Because what bothered him is these pyramids were not only different in size. I'm trying to find where you won't get a metallic glare. That's a good angle. Not only different in size, but the little pyramid was offset. From southwest to northeast on the plateau, all the pyramids aligned to true north. If you draw a diagonal, it will dissect on the diagonal the first and second pyramid, but the little third pyramid is offset to the left. Not only smaller, but offset. That bothered him. He couldn't find an explanation. Until one night, looking at the skies and the belt, those three dramatic stars that comprise the belt of Orion, he noticed something. That they too, right side, back off, they too are a larger, somewhat smaller, and a smaller one offset. And as you look at the picture of the pyramids, aerial view, side by side, back off till they're side by side, they reflect on Earth. Those main stars comprising the belt of Orion. He then began to pursue something that heretofore had been largely ignored in the calculations of the pyramidologists. You can come to me for a moment. Among the other things I have in the Library of Rutherford, which I have shown you many times, and pick me up on too, Chris, front on, unless I got something wrong with Ed's camera. Heretofore, I had not listened to it, but in that library was a tape of a lecture by Adam Rutherford given here in Southern California in 1952. And even Rutherford was calling the shafts that go out of the King's Chamber and the shafts that go out of the Queen's Chamber. And all the teaching to date, little has been said about these shafts. Look at them here. One going out of the Queen's Chamber, all the way to the outside, one going out of the King's Chamber, and then on the other side, one going out of the Queen's Chamber, most descriptions show it going a little higher, but not all the ways out, and one on the opposite side, going out of the King's Chamber. Rutherford is making a great deal of proving that these are not tombs, and I agree with him, but he is calling these air shafts or ventilator shafts. Put in there, he said, not for a dead mummy to breathe, but because God wanted, in this day and age, someone to go in there, and it would keep the air as it ought to be. Well, the truth is, these shafts were clogged, just like all the other shafts, until the present decade. We read in Tompkins' books of the opening of the well shaft and the Arabs first going into the shafts after they blasted open the downward passage and blasted around the plug that blocks the upward passage. Bat dung and bad air and serpents and dirt, and a pretty hairy experience, those first ones who went in. Well, these so-called ventilator shafts had never been opened. And it was assumed that the one from the Queen's Chamber on the left side of most of the diagrams and pictures, namely the south side, because you enter on the north side and are going south, so the south ventilator of the Queen's Chamber was assumed didn't go very far, just went a little ways up into the rocks. And with all due respect to Rutherford, as with all, they get into errors when they start speculating. These were clogged. The many tourists that have gone in there for some years, I'll read just a little bit to you before the half hour as I then come to the revelation of the discovery revealed in this book of those shafts. An important thing to understand is that those shafts were blocked and there was a problem with the tourists going in and out and the humidity of their many, many trips causing a real deterioration and a change in the health of the air inside the pyramid. He's got some specific, here we are. The Cheops pyramid is unique. Not only is it the largest and most geometrically perfect of them all, but unlike the others, it contains an elaborate system of above ground chambers. It is also the one most visited by tourists, and this has had the unfortunate consequences which could not have been foreseen when it was built. Each person leaves behind about 20 grams of water vapor in the breath and perspiration. And the air inside the pyramid had become unhealthy and overly humid. Not only was this uncomfortable for the tourists who were paying to go inside, but it was causing leaching of salt crystals inside the passages and chambers, making the porous limestone act like a sponge. In places, water was dripping from the ceiling. Salt and minerals within the stone were dissolved by the excessive condensation and seeped through to the surface, forming unsightly growths which would eventually cause flaking. Something had to be done to stop this process before the limestone blocks began to crumble and the whole edifice became unsafe. The task of finding a solution to the problem was put in the hands of the German Archaeological Institute, and they called Rudolf Gontenbrink in as a consultant to carry out the work. And it was part of this attempting to solve the problem of humidity that made them bring the robot, now gifted to the British Museum, that crawled up the passages after they opened them up and began to film, and discovered at the end of that southern so-called air vent of the Queen's Chamber that they thought didn't extend, found a door at the end of it. And a room beyond is suggested, but I'll get to that right after we go through the station break if you want me to continue. Huntington, West Virginia, listening on 5935 shortwave. You ought to try 5810 also. You might find it comes in as well or better. Won't be long, you'll be having your socks knocked off with our new station in Anguilla. Huntington, West Virginia. This is really interesting. Please send me some information on your ministry. Well, what do you want to know? Did a PhD at Stanford University, ordained minister, pastor of the largest Protestant church in the heart of Los Angeles, 46-year-old church, elected pastor, historic churchman, worldwide on radio, nationwide on television, 3 satellites worldwide, pastored here 18 years, in love with the Word. And what else you want to know? If I were a hybrid cross between a chimpanzee and a turtle, trust what you hear. I'm a messenger. If the message has got eyes to see light, that's it. We'll send you our pulpit if you want. But we don't play the games of most people. I'm interested in you hearing the message. Trust your ears. Apostle Robles, the BBC has done a documentary on this subject called The Great Pyramid. It was presented tonight on Satellite Morales 2, Channel 13. We get that satellite. I'm sorry we didn't check it and record it. It should be available through their arts and entertainment division. One of the examples, the aerial photos of the pyramids, was overlaid with the stars in Orion's belt, and they matched perfectly. They took an aerial photo of all the pyramids in the area and overlaid that with the entire Orion constellation, and they matched. It was mind-blowing. That's right. You are absolutely right. It's mind-blowing. But God created the universe. And I'm sorry that all these people try to lay this on some Pharaoh in Egypt. No. Sorry about that. Let's go back to the air shafts, okay? Somebody called in and said, don't leave me in that shaft. The most obvious solution to the immediate problem of humidity was to increase the airflow through the pyramid. Throughout it, this was not so difficult because there were already in existence two small shafts running from the king's chamber, the uppermost of the three, through the core of the pyramid to the outside. That's true. These two, take a look, from the king's chamber. I'm going to get the camera on my cigar. The one running toward the north and the one running toward the south, they reached all the way out and opened to the outside. It seemed likely that once these air shafts had been cleaned, and that's the traditional name for them, though with the prevailing winds in the area, air shafts would have been better put horizontal, then you didn't have to go through all the rocks. They're on air shafts. It seemed likely that once these, quote, air shafts had been cleaned and made to work more effectively, the atmosphere inside the pyramid would improve. Accordingly, Rudolph, the designated head of the project, and his team designed and built a machine called Upuaut, meaning opener of the ways, an ancient Egyptian and originally the name of a jackal god associated with the dead. I've got a picture of it. Here's a picture of it. Actual picture of the robot. See the camera mounted on it? Now here's the opening of the air shaft in the Queen's Chamber. This device had a camera mounted on it. Am I boring you? I didn't think so. And could be hauled up and down the shafts by pulleys and cables fixed in the king's chamber. That was the first one, not the one I showed you a picture of. Allowing inspection of the ducts from the inside. Once the debris of centuries had been removed from the shafts, a series of heavy-duty electric fans were fitted into them so that fresh air would constantly be drawn up into the pyramid, and by this simple means, the humidity inside was brought down to the ambient level of the desert outside, making the atmosphere healthier for visitors and safeguarding the pyramid from further deterioration. This first phase of the work was now complete, and Gontam Brink had returned to his home in Munich to bring back a new robot, Upuaut 2, to explore the shafts in the Queen's Chamber. Unlike the first robot, it had its own traction system so that it could climb up and down the shafts unaided. It also carried headlights, a laser guidance system, and a small video camera. Now, I'm telling you, this is God's word and God's testament, as Isaiah said, for the last days. None of this could have been found out until this modern scientific age. And it had its own traction system so that it could climb up and down the shafts unaided. It also carried, I repeat, headlights, a laser guidance system, and a small video camera to send back pictures to a monitoring console. Upwat 2 was a highly sophisticated robot and looked like a remote-controlled moon buggy. Take another look at it. Sorry, you folks on radio can't see it, but you just got it described. Looked like a remote-controlled moon buggy. Now, this author was wanting to meet with Gottenbrink, and he was not due back until March 6th of that year. I think it was 92 or 3. 92, I think. And Stadelman said he'd arrange a meeting for the 7th of March. I said this was cutting it fine for me since we were leaving Egypt that day. Stadelman hoped Gottenbrink might see me on the evening of the 6th, but he couldn't promise this. Now, remember, the air vent going south from the Queen's Chamber was surmised to be abandoned because the king said, you're not high enough, so forget this one. I don't need to breathe here anyway after I'm dead, so go on up a little higher. On March 5th, after a long evening walk on the Giza Plateau with the constellation of Orion putting on a wonderful display at the meridian, I left a note at his hotel for Rudolf Gottenbrink. I hoped he'd see me the following evening and give me a brief interview. He did. Rudolf's interest in Egyptology had begun when he heard of the shafts and realized that his robots could help in this sort of exploration. He had already taken his new robot, Upwat 2, about 20 meters up the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber, showing that the shaft was not abandoned by its original builders, as the funeral coffin holding egomaniac monument believers had said. They had stopped the exploration to make some modifications to the machine so as to go deeper into the shaft. Gottenbrink had no idea how deep, but said we might be surprised by what might be found in the end. He wondered what my prognosis was now that he had been told of my astronomical findings. I said that whatever was found would be something to do with astronomical events, something connected with stellar identity. He smiled and assured me I would be one of the first to know the results. He promised to send me his new measurements on the slopes of the shafts and hinted that Petrie's measurements were not quite right. This was exciting news, and he promised to fax me the new readings as soon as he had clearance to do so. We parted. I then received a fax from Rudolf, apologizing for the delay, apologizing, giving the measurements for the slopes of the King's Chamber shafts. You see, all the other openings and tunnels have been measured ad infinitum. But these just were written off as air shafts. not important to the careful measurements that make up the magnificent alignments of the pyramid. But now that they're being explored, as was the case in the refinement of the scored lines and the angles of the passageways, now the continuing study is opening up with new clarity and accuracy the angles of these so-called air shafts. And he sent the measurements of the slopes of the king's chamber shafts, the so-called air shafts, still working on the queen. As I suspected, they were slightly different from Petrie's, which had been used by so many previous studies, and consequently from those used by successors in their calculations. And he gives a table showing comparison. I then realized immediately that all the slopes were slightly steeper than previously assumed. Now remember this, once in 26,000, between 25 and 26,000 years, in the precession of the equinox, and again, not everybody who listens to me have any basic astronomy. I don't mean to put down those who do. But the Earth, as you extend the axes of the Earth as an imaginary line from South Pole to North Pole out into the vault of the heavens, it passes in the zodiacal movements as the Earth does its movements and the Sun and the universe and everything is moving. And you pass from age to age, such as we're just going in or coming into the age of Aquarius. In the earliest times, the reason the bull is so prominent in early ancient mythological religions, they were in the age of Taurus. About every 2,000 years, in the precession of the equinoxes, you move into a new age. Because as the Earth revolves on its axis, because of a factor between the gravitational pull of the Moon and the Sun, primarily, like a top that is slowed down in its spinning and begins to wobble just before it collapses, there is a slight wobble in the spin of the Earth. It's not a perfect sphere, and the gravitational pulls, as I've said, of the Sun and the Moon, primarily, cause a slight wobble. And if you were to extend that axis of the Earth out into the vault of the sky as though it were a blackboard to be written on by a pen that represents the end of that axis pushed out into the sky, the slight wobble would draw a little circle, and the true north is determined by where that axis points. The star it hits is the North Star in a particular constellation as the wobble goes on. In between 25 and 26,000 years, it completes the full turn of the wobble. And thus, about every 2,000 years, the axis, on, because of the wobble, is pointing to a different place in the constellations, and a different North Star moves in place. Presently, the North Star is Polaris. But if you go down the descending passage of the pyramid, you can't see Polaris at the bottom. Most of the way down you can, because the difference is slight in that wobble. But exactly 2141 B.C., you would be looking at Thuban in the dragon constellation, because it was built to teach a message of man's downward progress under the influence of Satan and God's rescuing work to the end of time. Now what he is finding, and the degrees and angles are so important, only the angle of that pyramid will give you pi, and any other angle will not give you pi, square a circle, and be a representative of the north half of the globe. The degree of angle of the Christ triangle and the angle of the slopes determines its rhomb line connection with Bethlehem. This is precise mathematics on moving instruments in the universe. So now they're carefully measuring these so-called air vents and finding something out. All the slopes were slightly steeper than previously assumed. And because of that, he's saying the age of the Great Pyramid would prove slightly younger. I quickly did the calculations. North-south shafts, the King's Chamber, and where they're oriented as you look out into the sky. He says, as he recalculates, and quickly give me a picture that I don't want you to have the detail. It just bore you. Come on, get to my pencil. He gives a little chart of recalculation from where, going up, following my pencil, Petrie's measurements versus Gothenbrink. Gothenbrink, Petrie, and he comes to a conclusion. The conclusion is inevitable. And he jumps. The Great Pyramid was built. No. Whoa, come to me. Wasn't built. It's aligned to. Doesn't mean it was built then. He's jumping to a conclusion. But let me finish his sentence. The conclusion was inevitable because of these alignments that I'm going to show you in a moment. Quickly follow me. The Great Pyramid was built somewhere between 2475 B.C. and 2400 B.C. Thus, an average epoch of circa or about 2450 B.C. No, my dear friends, to sound Christmassly, and it's not circa about 2450 B.C. When he spends some more time, he's going to find it's 2441 B.C. About is 9 years off. 2441 B.C. And that doesn't mean that it was built in 2450 or 2441 B.C., but that the date 2441 B.C. is a specific alignment. As we found, the alignment between the Dragon Star, go back to this diagram, and Alcyon occur at 2141 B.C., now we're discovering that there are... Woo! I saved everything. Thanks to my sore leg, my table is a disaster to make room for my leg in the air. Quickly. What we now are finding is that 2141 B.C., get in here close. Not only do we have the markers lining up Alcyon and the Pleiades and Thuban, though it would be lined up out here in 2141 B.C., not to scale on the angle. You also have the air shaft going north from the Queen's Chamber, hitting the current North Star in Ursa Minor with a little dipper, Polaris, and the air shaft going north from the entrance or from the King's Chamber also lines up with Thuban. And the air shaft where he found the door and the possible additional room is lined up on Sirius, the Dog Star, and the other side of the King's Chamber is lined up on Orion from the influence of Thuban, testified to twice, to the end of the King's Chamber, lined up on Orion. Now, who is Orion in God's gospel in the stars, where the King's Chamber takes us? Orion, the coming prince, and it is lined up on the star That one that is so bright in Orion's belt, which means the wounded one who is the coming prince. If you want me to continue. 3, now we have all of these measurements converging on the marker time, confirming the prophetic timeline. But more than that, a reason for the choice of these stars, Orion, Alcyone, Thuban, Sirius. You want me to continue? Get on the phone. How many of you didn't make it through 94 and aren't here? Don't take any more calls. I'm sure those people will not call. All right. I mean, now, without fighting the clock of station break coming up, summarize the Orion mystery, Robert Bobal and Adrian Gilbert's analysis of these air events. Not drawn exactly to the scale as this drawing, but as the descending passage at a particular time of the equinox in 2141 is aligned with Thuban at the same time it's aligned with Alcyone. Thuban is aligned with Orion, same year. The belt, the large star on Orion's belt, and Polaris, the current North Star, is aligned on the opposite side with Sirius, the dog star. As I said, Orion dominates this pyramid. Orion being the coming prince, and the star on which it's focused, the wounded one. I'll come back to that later. It's just that now we have discovered in 1993, 92 and 93, that recent, that not only were the scored lines and these passages aligned to specific stellar arrangements, coordinated with them, these so-called air shafts are also aligned, adding to the magnificent display of knowledge of the universe from these so-called primitive builders of the pyramid. Now, let me go on with this exploration before I come back to the star groups and their meanings in the message where God coordinates his message in stone with his message in the stars as his message in the Word, Isaiah 19, pointed to this witness and testimony to God that stands at the border and center of Egypt to be there as a testimony in the last days. And God times the uncovering and the revelation of this great witness. The real excitement was that Rudolph's latest measurements confirmed that the top shaft pointed to Al-Mitak, the lowest star in Orion's belt, which corresponded to the Great Pyramid in the Orion correlation theory. So it's the Great Pyramid that is aligned to the biggest star, the lower one, in Orion's belt. The three shafts now locked in perfectly to the stars and to the epoch of circa about 2450 B.C. I'm telling you, 2141. It's like Belikovsky coming within 6 to 8 years from his decipherment of the Alamana tablets that tell the Egyptian side of the Exodus out of Egypt, and coming within 6 or 8 years of 1453 for the Exodus. Rudolf had no data yet on the northern air chamber in the Queen's Chamber, but he thought its angle, properly measured now, might be closer to 39 degrees. A quick check suggested the same date of circa 2450 for the center of the four stars forming the head of Ursa Minor, the Little Bear constellation. Another tie-in. We'll save that. Rudolf had told me of his discovery on the telephone, and on 4th of April, a videotape arrived from Munich. I quickly put the tape in and watched as the robot appeared outside the Great Pyramid. Am I boring you? It's pretty late.
No, sir.
Rudolf put the robot into the opening of the southern shaft in the Queen's Chamber. Right here. The one that goes south. We showed you a picture of that opening. I'll show it to you again. Here's the little robot. You pull out two, and here's the shaft in the Queen's Chamber. You see how small it is. That's why it hasn't been measured. I mean, who's going to climb up that one? If there had been a small enough Britisher, it would have been done in the 1850s. But it took this robot to go up that shaft. Rudolf put the robot into the opening of the southern shaft inside the Queen's Chamber, then guided it with the controls on a worktop inside the chamber. The robot began filming inside the shaft, slowly and laboriously, slowly and laboriously, it slowly and laboriously, it climbed. Slowly and laboriously, it climbed, going upwards, slowly and laboriously, it climbed, going upwards, for about 65 meters. Slowly,
slowly,
it crept. Slowly,
slowly,
and laboriously it climbed, going upwards for about 65 meters before slowly. And laboriously, it climbed, going upwards for about 65 meters before coming to if you want me to continue, get on the telephone. Los Angeles, don't take any more calls. Los Angeles call saying, I don't care if you're live or not, I need spiritual food, and you are the one I listen to. I'm live. Well, thank you for that. Belmont, Port of Spain, Trinidad, West Indies calling. It gives me great pleasure to hear the Word of God coming into the West Indies. It's really good to hear real historical teaching on the Logos and respect to God's teacher. I've been listening since 12 this morning. I'd like to request your literature. May God bless you and keep you happy New Year. Hawthorne, this is no time for the Glendale Dangler. Keep going, please. Somebody said, continue, please. I'm slowly and laboriously tying a hangman's knot. The robot began filming inside the shaft. Slowly and laboriously, it climbed, going upwards for about 65 meters before coming to a stop. In front of it, clearly visible, was what looked like slowly and laboriously it climbed, going upwards for about 65 meters before coming to a stop. In front of it, clearly visible, was what looked like a miniature portcullis slab of the sort used by the Egyptians to seal off. And he has to put this in, a burial chamber. They call them burial chambers. Chambers. Attached to the slab or sliding door were two copper fittings. John behind me said, damn. Got a cameraman listening. Attached to the slab or sliding door were two copper fittings. You understand, if this is true copper, you're going to have to rewrite the Bronze Age? Tells you how sound their ideas are. One of which was broken, a fragment of it lying on the floor of the shaft. This last part of the shaft was lined with polished Tura limestone, which as far as we know was used inside the pyramid only for lining chambers and was considered sacred by the pyramid builders. It could also be seen slowly. It could also be seen from the movement of the robot's laser beam that the slab at the end of the shaft was not fully in contact with the floor, but left a gap of about half a centimeter. There was a triangular chip removed from one corner, providing a tantalizing glimpse of a grooved channel and a dark recess beyond. Though not conclusive, the video evidence was that what we were looking at was a hatchway leading to some hidden chamber. The approximate location of that hidden chamber I think I got a picture. Slowly and laboriously, I will look for the picture of the chamber. Slowly and laboriously, I'm still looking for the picture of the chamber. Slowly and laboriously, you can see how I mark my books up. Slowly and laboriously, I'm looking for, there it is. This is the position of the door. What's behind the door has not yet been determined, because you cannot go up the shaft and knock the door out. And the Department of Antiquities in Egypt would have to allow permission to blast in from the outside. I grabbed the phone. I would too. And called Rudolph. I congratulated him on the amazing discovery, and we discussed the details that I had observed on the video. He was, of course, reluctant to speculate what might be beyond the door, but he had trouble hiding his excitement. I told him this was big news, and that he should go to the press. In fact, I was really surprised that nothing had come out in the Egyptian papers. Everybody has a fixed opinion. They don't want to face evidence that might prove them wrong. He had heard that they were preparing a statement, but he was not sure. I urged him to consider letting me go to the British media and at least make sure that the story named him as the discoverer. I decided that I should try the Times or the Daily Telegraph. I called the Telegraph, got one of the editors, Christine McGordy. An interview was arranged, and the story was due to appear on the 7th of April. Meanwhile, I asked Rudolph if I could show the tape to Dr. Edwards, another scholar he had been talking with on the subject, and he agreed. He allowed me to show it to anyone who was interested, provided it was not broadcast on TV channels or photographs taken from it. On April 6th, the day before the article came out in the Telegraph, Adrian and I arranged to show the tape to Dr. Malik and his colleagues at the Griffith Institute at the Ashmolean Museum. They were stunned. And a vigorous debate ensued as to what exactly we had all seen. Air shafts, mind you. One thing was certain, there was no doubting the importance of Rudolph's discovery. Even assuming that no chamber existed beyond the slab. Right. This was the first time that any ancient metal has been found inside the pyramid. And if the copper fittings on the door turned out to contain more than about 2% of tin, the entire Bronze Age would have to be redated. Right. Even the skeptics in our audience couldn't help being excited at the possibility of a find comparable with Tutankhamun's tomb. We then drove to Dr. Edwards' home, showed him the tape. He was thrilled at the discovery and wondered if more data were available. We called Rudolph in Munich. He and Dr. Edwards had a long conversation. Dr. Edwards wanted to see the tape several times, each time picking out new details and asking more questions. He was, of course, keen to know how far the shaft extended above the floor of the king's chamber. A rough calculation showed that it went about 20 meters above that level. Aren't you dying to have it measured with pyramid inches? And this alone suggested that the Queen's Chamber certainly had not been abandoned, as the tomb theorists had suggested. It was pyramid history in the making. And Dr. Edwards suggested that Rudolph should come to England immediately to give a talk at the British Museum. I later saw Rudolph. He showed me various videotapes on the shafts, and one which he thought would especially please me. It was the filming of the Orion shaft, the southern one of the King's Chamber. The one that leads to the door out of the Queen's Chamber points directly at the same time to Sirius, the dog star. He wanted to show me the filming of the southern chamber out of the King's Chamber that does open up on the outside of the pyramid. It had been taken by Upaut I, and the pictures were breathtaking. The faint speck of light from the outside of the south face of the pyramid as the robot went up the so-called air shaft, becoming larger and larger until it was a sizable rectangular opening. Rudolph, remember, all of this was covered originally by the marble limestone casing. Even the door to the main downward passage was so finely cut, even though it was hinged to swing open, that the Arab in 820, the Caliph in 820 A.D. could not find it and just began blasting at random in the area. Now, with the limestone casings having been torn off, thank God for the sands that covered the ones at the base that enable us to project the measurements that weren't torn off. They've been used to build mosques in the Cairo area. The opening became larger and larger until it was a sizable rectangular opening. Rudolph's assistant, who was on the outside of the pyramid, standing precariously on the face of the monument, pulled the robot out, and the video camera kept filming the stunning view of the second and third pyramids below in the Nile Valley to the east. We asked Dr. Edwards what he thought might be behind the door. Edwards said he thought there might be. You want me to continue? Get on the telephone.